One, two, three, four.
How can we unlock a state of flow in our daily lives? How does connecting with nature influence our mental and physical well-being? How do movement, dance, and play help us feel more creative, connected, and content?
Dr. Julia F. Christensen is a Danish neuroscientist and former dancer, currently working as a senior scientist at the Max Planck Institute for Empirical Aesthetics in Germany. She studied psychology, human evolution, and neuroscience in France, Spain, and the UK. For her postdoctoral training, she worked in international interdisciplinary research labs at University College London City, University London, and the Warburg Institution, and was awarded a postdoctoral Newton International Fellowship by the British Academy. Her new book, The Pathway to Flow, is about the science of flow, why our brains need it, and how to create the right habits in our brain to get it.
Julia Christensen, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here.
So when we look at nature, Julia, and we see the true flow in the natural world, take back this murmuration of starlings, those tens of thousands of birds moving together in beautiful harmony, or the synchronization of fireflies, or the schools of sardines that move in like one shimmering mass, like the jellyfish blooms, where their bodies are pulsating in perfect unison. This is something you know from the dance world, that you were able to tap into this kind of collective intelligence that we've seen in coral reef ecosystems and all throughout the natural world, this expression of living harmoniously without effort. But as human beings, we're living in this increasingly complex world where data is being collected, doubling every 2 years, and we're bombarded with images and texts and social media news. It can be kind of difficult to find that natural flow, and people are finding it hard to relax and have that balanced, and our minds are becoming kind of trapped in a cycle of overthinking. So as a former dancer, neuroscientist, artist, you know, I dance myself, and I also find that when I dance, it frees my mind and I don't have time to overthink, kind of escape oneself. But today, as people are living with these constant inner interior monologues of rumination and self-doubt, how can people reconnect with that sense of flow, and what for you are the pathways we can take to free ourselves from overthinking and just experience that greater grace, energy, and creativity?
So while you were talking, I already got into a state of flow of just imagining all these beings being in perfect sync and harmony. And of course, as we know from some anthropological and archaeological work, it seems that we humans, with the special edition brain that we have between our ears, we've been admiring this sort of synchrony ever since. So drawings of beings moving in synchrony on cave walls, like cattle, for example, these swarms of beings that are with us on this earth that inspire us to look at them. And why do we look at things? Because the human brain will usually only attend to something that is relevant, either because it's dangerous, so we need to attend to get away, or because it is good and we need to have more of it for our survival. So our brain is structured around systems, very deep sitting systems that are important to keep us alive. And those, they tell us approach or avoid. And it seems very much that we approach synchrony and harmony in visual and auditory and tactile and taste and smell. So there's something when we're exposed in our senses to these cues that attracts us. And we know from modern neuroscience that our physiology, so our heart rate, for example, will synchronize with external cues, for example, other people. Now you mentioned dancing. So with the people who dance, when we dance with them, our breathing rates might synchronize. Without us willing to, we're joining in. And this synchrony, it basically has a very special effect on us also when it's, for example, other people that we're synchronizing with in a dance. And people who have been found to be synchronous in movement and physiology, they afterwards show more empathy towards each other. They like each other more. And when they're put to do a task, then they are more creative, more efficient in solving that task together than people who've maybe also been together in a room, but moving asynchronously or not moving together at all. So there's something about this flowy synchronousness in nature and us as part of that nature that is beneficial, for example, for the social connectedness of beings. So if I feel more connected to you, I will be more willing to do something for you, to collaborate with you. And funny enough, we seem to be more coordinated and also solving problems. So loads of advantages on the social side of being in synchrony. How that relates to flow, I guess that is a broad question because it depends a bit on how we might define flow. So now I'm a scientist today. I was not always a scientist. I used to be a dancer. So I definitely am speaking to you with my two hats. As a scientist, I will always have to define phenomena in a way that I could test it with an experiment, for example. And we would distinguish between the state of flow, this feeling of being completely absorbed into an activity so that time and space disappears, somehow compresses or expands. We do it for our intrinsic motivation, and we feel that skill and our depth, the challenge of what we're doing, are in perfect harmony. So it's neither too difficult nor too easy. And we have a clear goal in what we're doing. We know what we want to achieve. There's no competitiveness. We're just doing it because of the pleasure of doing it. That is a state that has been studied extensively by Hungarian scientists for decades, called Professor Mihály Csikszentmihalyi, who coined this term of flow. And that really his work took this to the stage of empirical scientific research, so to speak. But the state of being in flow and seeking out that state, sort of disappearing from the here and now, if you will, it must have been something that has been part of the human cultures for many millennia, because we know that, for example, dancing can bring you into these states. And we know from many anthropological works and graphic work today that people dance themselves into trance, a type of flow, for example. So there is that of flow in this scientific sense of a state of well-being. And we will speak about what that does to our brain and our broader well-being, but also the flow in what cues enter into our senses. So that would be a scientific field that looks at brain synchrony, physiology synchrony, like I was saying at the beginning about these waves that we see that sort of connect with us, and we then have incredible social benefits. And it seems that humans who did that to themselves might have had a competitive advantage over maybe other species that did not unite synchronously and did not have these advantages from doing that. So we should all synchronize.
That's so interesting. You have written about this, of course, in The Pathway to Flow and in your other book that you co-authored with Dong Song Chang, The Science of How Moving to a Beat is Good for the Body, Brain, and Soul. And it's so interesting. We don't even understand the different, it's like an archaeology of how culturally we have been responding. We have been working in flow. And in some ways, in our modern society, we have been unlearning this intergenerational wisdom, which is about cooperation and learning. I think that now might be a good time to share a passage from The Pathway to Flow, just to introduce to our readers some of the things you cover in your book and your body of work.
I would love to, because it really very much is a journey that I took, because I left the dance world, lost flow in my life, in my brain, and found it again through creative activities. So let's start the journey. Mindfulness. If you're human and alive, you have a brain, and this is a very special brain, unique in the animal kingdom. It has very basic neural system in place that allows you to survive in the wild, while at the same time, it also has neural systems that can write poetry, fairy tales, dance ballet on point, play improv on a saxophone, and create a delicious dish of pasta as an expression of love. Bizarrely or wonderfully, these systems overlap, and we can use this to our advantage to reach flow. Yet, we mostly know very little about this special edition brain of ours, how it works, how to engage it or appease it in order to learn how we can access flow states reliably and manage our brains in a way that improves our well-being. We first need to understand more about how it all works. And what I want to get at with this is, importantly, that research in the past decades has shown that people who tap into the state of flow regularly throughout their lives actually have a better health and well-being, both physical and psychological. And also it seems to make us nicer people to be around.
Yes, I think at one stage we all knew, like when we're children, we're kind of born dancers. We're just experimenting. We love our whole body and that, but we kind of forget over time. But how did it work for you on that personal level? You touched a little bit on your path from dance to neuroscience, but you know, all those things that you pick up instinctively. Just tell us about that.
Yes. So my first experiences with flow was clearly with playing, as probably most people. When you speak about flow to people, usually if they're not creative professionals, they will say, that's something I did as a child, and why should I care now? And then I quickly come in and say, because the science shows if you do this often, you will be healthier. The question is to describe it and then how to find it, of course. And the way I found it, well, as a child, I had it, and as probably all of us have. And then rightly, as you say, we unlearn it because it is no longer part of our culture to encourage play and to submerge yourself into anything without it having a grade at the end or some financial benefit. And these are behaviors that are not conducive to flow and that teach our mind to be very restless. This is, of course, something that I did not know. So as we're talking about my journey in and out of this flow state and back into it, my next experiences with flow were dancing in my parents' living room to the LPs that they had. It was a very natural thing to be doing. And I was enrolled in our dance education early. My path was to become a dancer. So I had never had a life without dancing, without having this flow. Of course, as I moved into professional ballet education, it became also a lot about technique and routines and competitiveness in a sense. But the flow was always with me because that was where I came from. But I remember once someone asking, so have you now learned all the movements of ballet? Or haven't you finished now? Aren't you done now? Can't you know, just stop? And that never occurred to me as a question, but that was someone who had never experienced or had forgotten how that was, that you just use your body not to learn steps, but to express, because that was what it was for me. It was a way of expression. So these contacts with people from outside the art world were always bizarre to me, but I never paid it much attention because I thought that's an outlier. But then because of an accident and severe injury to my back, I did not continue on the dance career side. And I was sort of catapulted out of the dance world and into the world that our culture is without arts. Arts in the general culture is something very, classy for a distinct audience sometimes. And many people that you ask about their art interests will say, I don't understand art, at least in this Western context. So that was a very new experience for me. And luckily, I had always been very interested in human behavior. And I found out that I could study human behavior, if not the dancing of it. And then I could at least study human behaviors, all of them. So I studied psychology, neuroscience, and also human evolution and cognition. And that brought me back to the arts in a very strange way, because doing that, studies and career in academia that brought me to a PhD and then as a scientist working now, I came back to the arts because I found by chance research on expert dancers and how their brains are different from those who don't dance. On flow, research on flow, I thought that was Professor Sisek Mihaly, who's been working on this for decades now. I made this my research career. So in a way, I got back to the arts through science, but that still didn't get me my flow back. So that's where the pathway to flow came in.
Yes, it's so interesting what you describe on a personal level, which does happen, unfortunately, with many dancers, that they get injured. But I think it's also a metaphor for the ways in which we've kind of, as a society, 75% of the world by 2050 will be living in cities. And we've kind of fractured our connection with both, as we were talking at the beginning of the conversation, our connection with the natural world and also with us embodied intelligence, this physical beings. We've kind of located our intelligence all in our brain. And we forget about the rest of our bodies, which is so important. We're not AI creatures. It's all being up in the brain. There's a lot of other stuff, as you know, going on subconsciously. And I recently interviewed Carlos Moreno, which I believe you know, he's the creator of the concept of the 15-minute city, which emphasizes the importance of connected, livable cities. And I wonder how you feel living in cities affects our natural flow and sense of connection to ourselves. These man-made environments with too much cement and gray infrastructure, with not enough green spaces, can just disconnect us from the earth and our own creative expression. So how can we make our outer worlds better reflect our inner needs for calm and connection, and, you know, design those spaces and communities that foster our creative flow?
Yes, you are touching on incredibly important points. Actually, one of the 7 important points, I would say, regarding how we can live a life that is conducive to flow. And point one is this connection with our body, our physicality. Our body needs around 150 to 180 minutes of aerobic exercise per week. So aerobic means that the heartbeat goes over 140 beats per minute. This number is due to research that shows that if we don't have it, the risks that we have for developing heart disease, diabetes type 2, some cancers, some infectious diseases increase statistically significantly if we do not have these body movement in our daily life. So 150 to 180 moderate exercise per week is a non-negotiable. Why? For a still mind. If we take such a behavior like sitting, which a lot of us do in our modern urban spaces, man-made is a chair. The sitting, most of us adults in Western world sit around 9 to 10 hours per day. This increases heart disease risk by 34%, and it is a health hazard. So our body, as it is connected to the brain, we often forget that. If we all touch the back of our head now and let our fingers slide down to the vertebrae of our spine, in there is a channel. And through this channel run long ganglia, that's nerve cells from our brain into our body, into our organs, into our muscles, tissue, out into the tips of our fingers, for example, funneling from little receptors in our skin, information of touch through the body up, through the spine, into the brain, into systems of our brain that are important for maintaining health and well-being, systems around the insula and the limbic system, for example. So through what we do with our body, we actually influence activation patterns in our brain. And sitting sends signals of danger to the body, to the brain. So what is the danger in sitting? Well, pressure, blood pressure is different when we sit. So that actually is already in the long run a signal to the brain, move, move, do something. You should not be sitting anymore. Then it stresses the lower back because the pelvis is bent forward. Sitting inclined forwards will compress the solar plexus, which also is a nerve bundle under our breastbone. So if we dance, we are de-stressing both the pelvis and the breastbone nerve bundle that sits there, the solar plexus, because we walk backwards or we move our arms up over our head. It's something we do naturally when we dance. When we sit, we do not. And all of these are stresses to the body. They are linked to messaging to the brain that something is wrong. These signals raise to our awareness through the interoception. Our interoception is the sense of our body from within. And this is a nonverbal sense. It comes through into our brain, and then we get this arousal, this urgency. Something needs to happen. I feel unwell. And activation is more of a yes, no, on, off kind of thing. And when arousal or activation like this that signals risk to the body arrives at the brain, what it does is that it co-activates memories that maybe are not so positive. Sad memories, angry memories, fearful memories, and they are connected to thoughts. And that's how sitting, an urban behavior of sitting, enforced onto us by our lifestyle, actually is conducive to rumination, because stuff that was not there before through this behavior that we are enacting with our body is actually propelling thoughts into our mind. And this brain-body connection is incredibly important to understand. We don't have one brain for art and one brain for all other life. It's all one. And through the behaviors that we enact, be they good or bad for health, we have a say in how our brain activates. And one final thing that you said about natural spaces, impressive work on the neuroscience of human nature interaction have shown that when we are among trees, among birds, so in nature, there is a biophilic effect. So our body and brain likes it, and it manifests in a specific activation pattern in the brain, alpha band activity, and it is a restorative activation pattern. It means when we are in nature, something in evolution did that when we're there, our brain resets. Restoration means we get rid of toxins. It means that our brain gets this default mode network activation that just is so good for resetting us, takes us out of the here and now. And so if we are in urban landscapes, even if they're very beautiful to look at, architecture, I love it, and we must look at it, and it is awe-inspiring, but we do need to make sure to be in nature regularly, because otherwise our body cannot relax. So that's what I would say to this question.
Yes, and even being around older buildings with their histories and harmony, as beautiful as they are, though I think maybe they correspond closer to this kind of natural rhythm that we have in nature, just the music of life, right? And also there's a music of silence that we are sometimes forgetting. It's quite, even in the natural world, and we're saying that everything is the natural world, but you know what I'm talking about, being out in the forest or being in the ocean.
Sure, sure.
It's not complete silence, but it's never pure stasis, but it's just not accelerated to the point that is like is AI and so compressed that there's no space for that silence and meditation. So as you reflect on meditation and those practices that help us connect with our truest self, you know, we are the stories that we tell ourselves, but as you also say, we are more than that, right? And we need that to kind of find that silence in order to get in touch with those other forms of communication. So where do you go in your mind when you disconnect from language? Do you ever reflect on what it might have been like before human language became the primary way we expressed ourselves? Because language has its limits and it can sometimes block those other senses and intuitive intelligence.
Yes, these are incredibly important points. And the quick answer is, where do I go? I go to creative behaviors, but I realize that that's not everyone's privilege, that they have curated an artistic or creative practice that they can go to. So for me, by putting myself in the right cue environment, my mind tips off into this state of flow very easily by drawing and by writing and by dancing, of course. Again, I rediscovered the connectedness with myself and the flow state through drawing. So where I was severely injured and could not move properly, I discovered that I could actually draw the movements on paper that I could not do anymore with my body, and through that tap into this expression of myself, nonverbal expression of myself through my body on those lines. So very simple, only line drawings that left open the world around them was important for me. And then the writing, which is verbal, sure, but honestly, I think every author can relate to what I will say now, that it comes to a part where you have automated the act of writing in such a way that what flows out of you is not verbal. It is words, but it is an expression. And so that links to this curation of the artistic practice, so that, as a scientist speaking now, the acts, the actions, the behaviors that you need, the drawing on the paper, the movements of the dance, go from explicit, effortful memory systems into implicit memory systems, where they really become your second language. So parts of our brain that encode gestures and make it possible for us to make gestures, so communicative gestures, they are actually the same neural pathways that also control our larynx, so part of our vocal apparatus. This means that gesture is actually a type of language for our brain. But of course, we need to foster this kind of skill first. And there are a couple of things that we might still touch on to be aware of to create that skill.
Yes, that's so interesting. I'm a visual artist, painter. Something that we forget about is that how, and some languages are more explicit, like you, the symbolism of each letter or each word or ideal concept, you can see actually the symbolism and the embodied intelligence because they're actual drawings. It depends on which languages you speak or write in. I'm wondering, you know, in terms of tapping into the creativity and collaboration that occurs in science, I think some people don't think about it that way, but there is a lot of creativity in science, but it manifests differently than in the arts. Like when you're collaborating with dancers or choreographers, artistic directors and composers, that's a different kind of collaboration. So I'm wondering how you transitioned from that kind of shared vision of creating dance or with your visual art, which I actually, of course, that's less collaborative, to fit the mindset of the scientific world, where there's still structure and experimentation, but it has different goals and expectations.
Absolutely. You speak my mind. So it is a big advantage that I have a background in dance and the arts myself. So I know the languages, the words of both sides, let's say, because sometimes it can't feel like science. So and compromises need to be made. So for research to be valid for both the artist and the scientist, a lot of communication and conversation goes into setting up the studies first, because there is, of course, the opportunity where the artist says, okay, I want this done. And then the scientist sort of becomes the executioner of an artistic question. And that might be interesting for the arts world. And then there's the other side where a scientist kind of uses dancers or artists as guinea pigs to prove some scientific theory, you know, so the service person and the guinea pig, and that shall not happen. That's so the discipline of empirical aesthetics, in which I situate myself, and neuroaesthetics is still rather young, even if the idea of studying the arts empirically collaboratively with the arts world is definitely already 100 years old. But this discipline is still in the making. So these conversations need to happen so that they're beneficial, not just for the arts and the science, but also the humanities, to have a very strong, obviously, body of research that both the arts and sciences can draw on. So these conversations happen and they're still to be expanded. So I have a lot of conversations with each collaborator that I have, and with mostly with dancers and choreographers in my case, because that's where I'm specialized.
It's interesting, those conversations. And obviously, as a dancer, you adapt. You're always watching and listening things. And so you have that vocabulary. But how do you find, I guess it's a way in for dealing with different people from the broader humanities, you know, who write critiques of works of art, and so not just practitioner artists and scientists. How did that help you understand and modulate and just be a better mirror collaborator?
Yes. So I wanted to say one thing specifically about dancers and collaborations with dance, because I work in contexts where there's a lot of music research and with musicians and conductors and visual artists. And these collectives of artists are usually very verbal and very good to, you know, express verbally where their boundaries are and what they want to do and don't want to do. While dancers, we are always too adaptable. Just like you said, there's no one really taking our stance. What might happen is more that the dancer then recedes into the background and this collaboration never happens because they realize they don't understand me. And my most important work at the beginning of a collaboration is to establish that trust, because obviously on my side of the conversation, there will be more scientists who do not have dance experience and who might not be aware of that. And so that the trust can be there that the dancers will stay in the collaboration is really important to me, and that they speak their mind freely, because there's always the thing of, you know, whoa, scientists, they know so much about the brain. Musicians don't seem to have that much in my experience, maybe because the art form dance is also always a little less appreciated than music, for example. It's in the society. I feel it myself when I'm approached by people from other scientific domains. They are like, dancing, oh, that's just some sort of courtship behavior, isn't it? Why should we study it? And music, oh yeah, music, classical music, that's an art form. So there is this to go against as well. So these are conversations that I keep having. And yeah, I mean, make sure that we have a shared vocabulary, verbal, that both sides agree on. So what do I mean by this? I sometimes feel that we need something like a Rosetta Stone. So a translation manual because scientists and artists use the same words for different behaviors. So subjective and objective, the word research, they are words that mean diametrically different things in artistic research and scientific research. So just agreeing on these three at the beginning is a work that needs to be done. And the humanities very nicely fit into this too, because they will tell the background of these words and how they evolved. And that's also interesting for everyone. So there is a phase of defining concepts, a Rosetta Stone for each project. And that might be different for different dance forms. So I don't only work with Western dance forms. And when we open up to work both sides, you know, so both non-Western and Western scientists and artists will open up to work with people across divides as they are nowadays. Other types of words need to be agreed on and understood by both sides. And it's a very rewarding and fun process because you discover stuff about yourself, about the others, and you become this oneness when we come back to this idea of synchronizing ideas and thoughts and physiological rhythms in those teams when we sit together, obviously synchronize and synergy happens on a physiological level too in this way.
It's true synchronizations. You have to be working with a creative or scientific or collaborative family for a long time to give it. It's amazing because this is the wonder, but the limitation of language. It's so nuanced, and yet we can still be at the same time talking about the same thing, but using completely different vocabulary as well. I have found, just to interject some of my own experience, I love language. And so I've spoken to maybe around 20 neuroscientists in this project. It's not my specialty. But then you go into talking with writers or talking with philosophers, then I find they're talking really about the same thing, but they just say, this is my vocabulary. And we actually don't disagree. We just think it's a different, choose different words.
Absolutely.
It makes it hard for me as a generalist moving through these different fields to believe in one truth. That's the thing. We all think we sort of have our truth. So we see the world, maybe not as it is, but as we are, as the saying goes. But that's the beauty of it.
It is. Not to give up. I think what you're doing is an amazing contribution to the arts and sciences. And it's brilliant. If it helps, I can say that I collaborate on works on neuroscience and law. So where neuroscientific understandings of human behavior can help the law understand more about criminal behaviors and terrible behaviors. And it's the same thing. We use different definitions for the same words. And we spend years writing one paper, actually 10 years. We've just published a paper on neural law conversations, specifically on this topic, on how we just use the same words, mean different things, and therefore never find agreements. But if we can define the vocabulary or just understand the different ways that we conceive of words like subjective and objective and research and things like that, or agency, what is agency? Just define the words, like really do a Rosetta Stone for your project. I find it very liberating because suddenly you understand actually we don't disagree at all. We agree on more things already before starting than we thought. We just needed the right words.
Yes, it's so true. The art of, we should say broadly, choreography or dancing is something that's a little bit, as you say, misunderstood, or people don't feel as much of a connection to it, perhaps as music might be more universally something that we experience and understand. But everything is a choreography. And I find when speaking with one of the major existential crises of our times, of course, climate change and what we're doing to our planet, this is also a problem of choreography and coordinating. And if we could all be moving in the same direction, like dancers or an artistic troupe, I think that we'd get there. And then maybe we can understand that choreography and dance is something that we all need. That's the way I see it.
So this has all been really interesting. And one thing that I've been thinking about is I've grown up in many different countries. And I know that you've worked in the UK, Spain, Germany, etc. And I'm just wondering if you've noticed whether any cultural context or historical context actually influence the way that people interact with art, creativity, and how it might affect the way that they will achieve the flow state?
Yeah, what a beautiful question. So the quick answer is yes, I have. And I feel so privileged for having had that experience because I have the impression, and I think you probably have too, that people who have stayed within their own realm for most of their life, they miss a richness, and that's a shame, right? So we can find inspirations of how people everywhere in the world interact with the arts and find flow and use maybe creative behaviors, particularly to get into flow and get the benefits, health and social and physical health wise. So my most, let's say, formative experience, I think, I mean, you mentioned Spain and you mentioned France. I've lived in these countries, but I've actually had a project since 2016 with Iranian researchers and dancers and artists, and was privileged enough to learn about a different conception of how the arts are viewed in that particular culture, and how dancing, for example, is also underestimated as well. If you ask an Iranian, can you dance? They will say no. And then you see them in a party and they are the first on the dance floor and the best dancers. And this has always been a great experience. And then also that it's much more part of the normal way of expression that people have in their everyday life. And that has been aimed extremely enriching. And our first publications on an Iranian social dance style are just out. And it's extremely exciting for me to tap into this resource. And then another very nice experience was while I was studying in Spain, we had a lot of visiting scholars from Colombia. And it was always fun chatting, especially to the men there, because for them, they couldn't understand why the European men would always stand at the bar and never dance and not be interested in dancing. And they would say, well, in my country, if you can't dance, you are not invited to a party. You are extremely uncool if you can't dance. So dancing, it was just this social thing that you did. And it was a way of connection. And he was always scolding the European ladies. You shouldn't, you know, invite that guy. He can't dance. It was a great way of just a different type of group pressure than we are exposed to in European context, where men are encouraged, please don't dance. That's weird. Don't dance. You know, and the right thing to do is not dancing. So our brain is plastic, meaning that it has the ability to adapt extremely well. And it is also a social brain, as we spoke about earlier, like being able to connect is important for survival reasons. Bigger groups survive better. So those who could adapt, be a bit conform with the norm, status quo of a place, they had an advantage. So if the status quo is don't dance, then unfortunately that is what our brain learns. Lucky enough, we can unlearn that. And some of that I try to do in the pathway to flow, like take away this sort of ivory tower idea of the arts that it's only for a few. It really is for everyone.
Thank you so much. And clearly what I've been learning about fostering this flow state in a way is there's a lot of learning and a lot of adapting and social kind of commitment related to it. And I was wondering how we might introduce this into educational programs or schools in order to facilitate learning and development in young kids or adolescents.
Yes. So I think that depends a little bit actually on the context and like which culture we're in, because some cultures already have a segue into the arts where crafts and calligraphy and possibly knitting and sewing and dancing and music making and singing are much more prevalent than in others. So depending on the, let's say, educational level of who you are talking to. So in Iran, people are extremely knowledgeable already with the arts just from school. Same in some, like Colombia, I know. So that will be a different starting point than someone in Germany, for example, Denmark, my home country, where that literacy in the arts is much lower, only in high arts. And I think that there are three important things that we want to transmit and that I try to encourage in the book also, which is learning to create for the creation itself. So not to strive after an outcome. So to learn to not, like you did as a child, learn to worry less about the outcome, that the outcome is something you can take a photo of and share on Instagram, because this striving is linked to a type of neural activation pattern, let's call it, that will be very dopamine, obviously, ridden. So you will strive and you will get this big high when you have likes on your social media or when you have a beautiful outcome. And that is not necessarily conducive to flow, this striving. It can actually make us extremely social comparison and this judgment that might come from others. It is extremely stressful for our brain and will make it unsteady. So by fostering this sort of outcome-based creation style where it has to look according to a certain standard, that will create very edgy minds, cluttered minds, worried minds, and will not be that conducive to flow. And they will not create or make a practice that can give them flow because there will always be anxiety riddled of what that might look like at the end. So finding ways of teaching that the process matters more than the outcome is important. There's this Danish drawer, Kasper Kopke, he speaks about, it's not important what you draw, but that you draw. And that is very aligned with the neuroscience of learning, where you want the dopamine to learn the right movements. So that's what you have to focus on. And don't worry about the outcome. So there are like intervention studies showing that creative writing, for example, it can be conducive to better health indices. So people who write expressively, just 20 minutes, twice a week, for a period of time, throw it away afterwards, don't show it to anyone, just express, download it to the page. After 6 months, they have less doctor's visits, better health indices, like better immune markers, better wound healing. And that's without this outcome focus. Okay, so there's science that shows, hey, we should try to give people back this joy of playing with whatever I have in my hand right now, be that wool that I'm knitting or crafts, materials that I put together in ways that just please me in this very moment, and it doesn't matter what it becomes at the end. So that's a very important aspect.
I find this discussion on the flow state and creativity very interesting and very relevant today, especially as many of us navigate through the complexities of daily contemporary life. For many of us, it's easy to feel overwhelmed because of school, work, family, what feels like never-ending tasks and deadlines, and the pressure to always be productive. I know I've felt it, especially as a student, balancing various assignments, extracurriculars, part-time work, applications, social life, etc. In moments like these, I think about Dr. Julia Christensen's work on the pathway to flow. Flow is more than just a state of focus or mental clarity. It's like finding your rhythm, the optimal condition where everything is aligned with each other, in complete unison. For me, it reminds me of those times when I'm lost with my guitar or deep into a good book on a subject I'm passionate about, like philosophy. I lose track of time, I disengage from my other surroundings, from what isn't, at that time, relevant, and everything else seems to slowly fade away. I've realized in times like these, I'm not just working for an outcome or an end goal, I'm fully immersed in the process itself, almost like engaging deeply with something meaningful, where the act of doing is fulfilling in and of itself. It's that elusive feeling we often experience when we're small, when we're children, when time melts away while we're immersed in child's play, unaware of how much more the world really has to offer. However, I fear the older we get, the more we lose touch with the external natural world in a way. We lose this natural sense of flow, often because society pushes us towards productivity, status, and financial-based achievements. Yet, as Dr. Christensen suggests, it is within the act of creation, the act of creative expression, without judgment or prejudice, that we can truly discover the intrinsic joy of simply doing. We just need to step away from the outcome. I recently read a paper by Monroe C. Beardsley called On the Creation of Art, where he touched on the finalistic theory, which is where every creative action taken is steered by a clear, predetermined vision of the final outcome, with each step aimed at achieving some specific end goal. But this theory, as Beardsley says, can reduce creativity to a very fixed, predetermined path, neglecting the authenticity and spontaneity that truly defines the creative process. I believe that Dr. Christensen's work on the flow is closely aligned with Beardsley's critique and his understanding of creativity. In a flow state, we release ourselves from the burden of an inflexible outcome, allowing the process itself to shape our actions and decisions. Now, rather than being restricted by a preconceived notion of success, we are free to explore, to adapt, to discover new opportunities and new wonders. This is where the art of flow truly lies. And maybe that's a key takeaway from the pathway to flow from this episode, to let go of these fixed expectations and simply engage with the moment, to go with the flow, as some might say. It's about allowing the process to lead us rather than forcing ourselves toward a predetermined destiny. By doing so, I'm sure we can rediscover the joy we used to feel towards creation, reconnect with ourselves, and find a deeper, more meaningful sense of flow in our everyday lives.
I think as artists and all of us, we have this creative capacity. There is no such thing as perfection. So that aiming for it, sometimes in my mind, the perfect work of art doesn't exist. And if there's too much perfection, well, it seems robotic. So in fact, it's not perfect because it doesn't connect with human beings who are themselves imperfect. But you say something very important, this idea that we have these cluttered minds and we should aim towards that kind of ecology of mind, because we're often talking, we talk about climate change, but there's also clearing ourselves of the mental pollution. It's not just the pollution out there in the atmosphere, CO2 or plastics in the oceans. We have this kind of mental pollution that's created maybe from technology, and arts are a way of releasing it, and then becomes a kind of diary making, as you say, a daily practice of knowing ourselves.
I can really resonate with what you say there. And this actually also links to the rise of AI and the implications that that has for the arts world and for us as creators. Because so as we produce, let's say, shapes on a paper, or with our body, we conform to an aesthetic standard, or we make music that sounds in a specific way. So syncopation is now the big thing. It will induce people to groove and to like your music more. So let's have a lot of syncopation inside your music and you'll sell a lot. So by doing this chase for the beauty, for this superficial beauty, which is what AI gives us at the moment, it gives us perfect outcomes. Not that any of what they produce, these models, is perfect, because how do you evaluate perfection? But they are based on the data that most people want to see again. So that is extremely important to bear in mind. And so when you say cluttered mind, that is actually also a cluttered brain in the sense of what neurotransmitters are out and about there. So as we strive after that perfect coding and that external beauty, our brain again has all these little dopamine signals. Dopamine is good. Dopamine is a learning signal to the brain, but we need to know how to use it. So if we constantly swipe our phone, get this beauty into our brain, basically by our eyes in this case, or via the syncopations and the music, we are teaching our mind to seek that all the time, because that's a dopamine signal. It's a learning signal. So that clutters your mind to strive after these shapes and this kind of sound cue or whatever it is repeatedly. So that clutters your brain, and that's why your mind is full. So this is a process that we're only starting to uncover now, which is also why it's important to work with people who are not just hardcore neuroscientists, who can tell you about how the brain interacts with its environment. Because what it does is that it teaches us an unrestful mind, a mind that can't stay put.
One question I was wondering is that there's a lot of ideas of meditation, kind of emptying your mind, having a clear mind. And I wanted to know if someone considered themselves not that much of a creative person, or someone couldn't really cultivate the arts, would you say that there was a mode to having a flow state through mindfulness practices and meditation instead of actual creative expressions?
Yes. So it's a very relevant question in this context. And I think there are several answers to it. It's not that easy of an answer, because we humans vary a lot. So there's a lot of neurodiversity. And I'm so glad to see that in the last years, we're gaining more and more awareness of how brains are different and how that is okay. So then the next step, however, now is, oh, right, how do we cater to all these diversity? I myself have ADHD. So sitting still, when I'm already sitting a lot in the day, it's not what is going to be really easy for me. So knowing that our brain is a movement junkie, and that actually our body needs all that movement that we started talking about in this call, 150 to 200 minutes per week, at least, of aerobic exercise, that actually helps already, point one, to unclutter your mind. So maybe you have a creative practice, but you don't seem to be able to submerge you into it. Well, try with that movement. Try to have that for a couple of weeks. Maybe you will suddenly be able to submerge yourself into that book you like reading, or that writing that you always wanted to do, just because you gave your brain that move. Then if we're already struggling with focus, which many of us are from many different, so that might be anxiety, that might be ADHD, it might be depression, it might be some social phobias. There are many reasons for having this cluttered mind. So for each, there will be different ways. But one important thing is to understand what these mind hooks are, these hooks that extract us from the zone and that teach our mind to be unsteady, any mind. So things like I said, competitiveness, judgmentalness. So when we put ourselves into contexts where we're being evaluated, it's okay. We need to do that for our job, maybe to succeed in life, might be, but reserve spaces without competitiveness. Then two, mind hook two is what I call the pleasure seeking that we spoke about in relation to AI, where we chase this beautiful shape, but it's hollow. And also for our brain, it's a very low level learning signal that makes us chase constantly after this shape, and that's it, and no depth. So no connection. And that's this pleasure hook. Careful with it. It's good to have in your life, but take times without it. And then there's one more hook, and that's the risk seeking. We all have different levels of sensation seeking. So there's a lot of this stuff going on. Oh, to be in the moment and just hover there. Right. But what if the moment is just not very interesting for me? I spend a lot of time actually in the book also trying to uncover a bit what it is that we can create in our surroundings so that the surroundings are interesting for my brain, so that the cues that come through my senses into my brain make it want to be in this very moment. And of course, creative activities and cues that I make will be very helpful in that, because I will put around me what I like, the colors, the textures, the smells. Maybe I will always have a specific sweet when I start, or I'll do specific movements. I mean, all artistic creative professionals have their creative movements that they do every day. The singers, the voice artists, they do their voice exercises. A dancer does their bar every morning. A drawer makes their lines every morning. Turner, every morning, first class of the Royal Academy, just drawing live. You know, you need to make that practice yours with the cues around you that you like, so that your sensation seeker of a brain, which, as I started by saying, we have this old school brain that made us survive in the wild. It had to be able to seek sensations, look for innovation, seek new territories. That's the same brain we still have. We can't bore it. And depending on who we are, we will need more or less of that. So finding that sweet spot that is neither too much nor too little, so that we can stay in that moment, that's the third mind hook. So competitiveness, pleasure hook, and the risk or sensation seeking hook, to be aware of, just to know, to navigate this modern world that is so full of distractions. Because if we don't, we will teach our mind to be very distractible and unsteady. So if I want to learn to meditate, so if people don't want to have a movement meditation or a creative art as our meditation guide, because creative activities can be a meditation and give you flow. If you want to try meditation and you haven't been successful, maybe look there. Read a bit about neurodiversity. Could I have ADHD? Is that maybe why I can't sit for so long? Or am I sitting in my work for 9 hours straight, and that's why my body just won't do it? My mind won't empty itself. It's not possible to empty your mind if your mind is full. Our brain will never be off. Like, it will always be on, because it's keeping us alive. And if there's signals from the body telling it, move, you will not be able to focus. So that movement junkie of a brain needs to be appeased. And then teach your brain to know about these three mind hooks, and then maybe look at, how do I actually create a practice so that in our busy lives, we don't have time to submerge ourselves in hours of flow every day, but we might need flow every day. So how to get it for 5 minutes, just like take away 5 minutes. Well, I have to create the habit in my brain. And so I spent some time in the book explaining how to do that.
Yes, you might be seeing odd to get up from your desk. I mean, not for you, because I know you do this, but I have to be static as well and just have that 5 minute dance break. So just going back on the importance of the arts, you know, and the role of art in helping us understand, were there any specific artworks that were of particular meaning for you that you return to in your role as a dancer, as an artist, and a neuroscientist, that just help you make sense of the world?
That is a good question. I reread books that have really changed the way I look at the world. I think it's important I don't say which ones they are, because I want everyone to have that and not strive after what might have done it for me. It could be anything, really. And that's what, for example, literature, there's research showing that it can give us this feeling of awe and being moved, and yeah, this sort of joy that have a transformative effect on us. So aesthetic emotions, as they are called, might also happen as in response to a nature episode or a building, like Sagrada Familia or something, where you feel so small and feel awe. And these transformative experiences are easy to have with the arts when you find this painting or thing that really does have that effect on you. And that might have different effects through your life. And so it's definitely, it has been books and paintings, some of the paintings of Picasso, particularly for me, which then intersects with difficulty of understanding more about who the artist was. And I do speak about that in my book, The Pathway to Flow as well, where the complications come in of who the artist is. And even if maybe the artist is dead, there might be implications of consuming artworks, understanding where they came from and who was the creator and in which context. And then obviously dances, but also dances that we did ourselves. So moments where, yeah, actually there were absolute synchrony and like really disappearing into the, I don't know, music world movement. I can't really describe it. These out of body experiences, usually not on stage, I should have said. They happen in dungeons of discourse, maybe to some people, or during rehearsals where something suddenly converges. Then the drawing experience that I had, that was my real way back. I had read about Turner, funny enough, of how he just did pencil strokes, and for some reason, I found that and came back to drawing myself, where I was gone for 6 hours, apparently, and did not realize it. Musical pieces through the years. That's a very powerful experience.
That's so true. And I think it's also in the individual pencil mark that you don't always see with painting can somehow be lost in the varnish, but that in spontaneous expression, as you're talking about in the movements of Turner, or just that other, where you can see that initial mark, I think, approximates the dance experience, where you can't redo, you just have that one shot. It's all an act of reverence, yes, I understand, in the rehearsal process. And I like, it is interesting, as you say, the problem of disconnecting the biography of the artist, whether it's Picasso, which maybe had problematic relationships with women, but still it connects us with this long history of the human experience. And it's just, as you say, it's awe-inspiring to be part of that long human story. And just reflecting on the future of education and mentorship and collaboration, what were some of those teachers or collaborators, mentors, had an impact on you? What did they teach you about life more broadly?
Yes. So there have been teachers at school, but also in the dance world, and they have had, I guess, different shaping effects on me. So I particularly remember one Danish teacher who taught me to believe in writing. So writing, just like dancing, was something I just did, and it was not something I thought about. And he kind of brought it to the forefront of my mind. Don't stop doing that. Stop doing what was my answer. And he was like, writing when you feel like it and make it a thing, like you dance. And sort of taking this out of this sort of total natural engagement with a behavior that is writing. And he said, don't lose it as you go through life. Bizarre thing to say to an adolescent, but it was very important because I have that anchored in my mind. And saying that to people, don't lose your playfulness when they are young, because as we're born apparently with this ability in place to find flow, we lose it and we should not. And when people ask me, so how do I find my creative activities? I often say, try to remember back to what you did as a child, or have you been told that you were doing something for hours on end and you couldn't be stopped? What was that? You know, and then trying to find your way back there. And I think what he did was anchor that something in my past. There were several other artistic expressions that I did intuitively, but that was one of the strongest ones apart from dancing. And then maybe for good or for bad, there has been a very like crucial person in the dance world, let's say like that, who brought the technique advancement that I needed, but in a way that also basically, how to say, so one of the things he always said was, when you're asked if you can do something, say yes and panic later. Then you go home and you practice until you can do it. Even if you can't do it, say yes. So that was this whole thing about that. And so he taught me to never give up, which is something that any professional dancer has at some point experienced, that there are people in the dance world that will teach you to not give up. That might be good or bad, you know, that you just go for it and never give up. Like, it just does not exist in your mind. That has helped me as a scientist. Bizarrely, people give up stuff. But I've found several people who have these double hats, like being a dancer, being a musician and a scientist, and we don't give up. And that helps the whole scientific process because it is very complex and very long. Eternal long, has a lot of red tape and box ticking and administrative stuff that makes you go, you know, very occupied and very annoyed. Things that you have to go through, but only if you do, you will contribute to the development of the discipline. So that I am so grateful for, that I was taught not to give up. And that came from the dance world, for example. That's two examples. I don't know if you want me to go on, but that's too important, I think, in this context.
Oh, I think for everyone. And of course, we never arrive there because as soon as we get to where we thought we were going, there are new questions that are opened up. So that's just the beauty of it. So just finally, in closing, as you reflect on, we talked about it now here with the way AI is changing the way we communicate with ourselves and our own imaginations. It's changing art, music, and so many things in the world of work and education. And sometimes we're losing that sense of imperfection and play as we're kind of becoming closer to our machines. How can we hold on to who we are in the face of this rapidly changing world? And as you think about the future and the kind of world leaving the next generation, what would you like them to know, preserve, and remember?
So this is obviously a very important question that everyone should be posing themselves, really. So interestingly, when we look at the science of when is the arts conducive to health and when it is not, we look at what we call treatment factors. So as scientists, we look at phenomena, we try to isolate what the different components of this behavior is, for example, and then we want to know which factor, which variable contributes most decisively to the output, being healthy, for example. So I said flow regularly is good for you, but what is it of the thing that you're doing that makes you healthy, right? So what the science shows about artistic, for example, dance interventions, it is that the factor that is most conducive to positive effects, for example, against anxiety or depression, is expression. It is this strange, ephemeral thing that is so hard to describe, where you express what you feel through your body into the world. Disclosure, basically. So people understand that when you write something out or that when you say something out with words, but developing that ability of expression through the body, be it a drawing, be it knitting something, be it building an architectural object in miniature, be it music or dancing, learning this as a second language. And each person might have a different second language, which is a creative one. And then focusing on the expression, not on the form, because the form AI will give you the perfect form. And I guess I'm very much in this realm of the expressionist theories of art in this way I'm talking. But if we're talking health effects and if we're talking leaving something meaningful, human expression and the communication is what held us together in the past. So what might also hold us together in the future, right? So learning that about arts, one of the important things is expressivity, not the beauty coating outside. That is the beauty. What, you know, we talked about before, about the pleasure hook that makes our mind unsteady. It's not what will connect us. It is what will alienate us. Because as I show myself as so pretty, it will have an alienating effect on others because they will want to compare themselves to me. And I will want to compare myself to them, and we are dividing and drifting more and more apart. And AI is helping us with that drifting apart because we make stuff more and more pretty. And so people can get jealous of each other and we are dividing. So again, focusing back, the science shows that it is when this authentic expressivity of my vulnerability expressed out in the world, that's when it's healthy for me. Of course, within a safe space. I spend quite a lot of time in the pathway to flow, making sure to say the expressivity has to happen in a safe space, and how to create that is also something we want to create in the next generations, so that the expression can happen within safe boundaries and be conducive to autonomous and healthy individuals.
That's so true. So thank you, Dr. Julia Christensen, for reminding us of the importance of embracing imperfection, the importance of play, and sharing your insights into neuroscience, dance, mindfulness, and creativity by helping us understand how through movement, flow, and awareness, we can reconnect with ourselves and the world around us and just synchronize with the beauty of this earth to find our creativity and purpose. Thank you for adding a voice to the creative process.
Thank you so very much for having me. I've enjoyed your questions, your scope, the perspectives, the questions that you asked me very much. And I wish to you and all of us, may the flow be with us.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Sebastian Klassen with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Sebastian Klassen. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.